I don't know if you've heard, but climate change is expensive.
When there is a cost, the cost is paid by people.
But the thing is, not addressing climate change is going to be a whole lot more expensive.
These storms are getting more unpredictable.
In this series from Living Planet, we're digging into the real costs of climate change,
how we can reduce those costs,
and just how much there is to save.
Find this Living Planet series on the costs of climate change wherever you get your podcasts.
Big news out of Rome, a new pope has been announced.
Un papa americano, un papa venuto dagli Stati Uniti d'America.
The first American pope ever. I'm Carolyn Beeler. What to expect from Leo XIV. And today, people mark 80 years since World War II ended in Europe. But celebrations have taken a somber tone.
In some ways, we're celebrating the 80th anniversary of a global system, just as that system is collapsing.
In Gaza, signs of malnutrition and starvation are dire.
The world has got to let aid back in.
A walk through the rice paddies of Japan in record heat.
It was like walking through a furnace and breathing through wet cotton balls.
Plus, reality TV, it just makes economic sense. That's all ahead today on The World.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. When the white smoke billowed out of the chimney above the Sistine Chapel today, very few people were expecting the man who was announced as the new Pope of the Roman Catholic Church. The cardinals elected American Robert Francis Prevost, who took the name Pope Leo XIV. He is the first American ever elected to the papacy. St. Peter's Square was thronged with jubilant Catholics welcoming and cheering for Pope Leo, who spoke to them and prayed with them in Latin, Italian, and Spanish from a balcony festooned with red velvet drapes.
Sancti Apostoli Petrus et Paulus, de quorum potestate et autoritate confidimus, ipsi intercedat pro nobis ad Dominum. Amen.
The transition of the papacy is a rare and major event, and the historic choice of an American makes it all the more so. We're joined by Megan Clark, a professor of moral theology at St. John's University in New York. Megan, how significant is it that this pope is American?
It's remarkable. I mean, if you had asked me, I never in a million years would ever thought I would see an American pope, as pretty much every theologian is saying right now. It really is remarkable, but he's a very particular American. And I think that that's what makes the difference in terms of how it is that we've ended up with an American pope.
Right. Tell us more about Robert Francis Prevost, now Pope Leo XIV. I know he has quite a global background.
Well, and that's the thing. So he is born in Chicago, went to Villanova, but... He, as an Augustinian, he served in Peru. He was made bishop in Peru. He was elected by his fellow Augustinians to be prior general.
And Augustinian, so, meaning of the Order of St. Augustine.
Yes. And so what that means is that his ministry is global in a way that I don't know of another pope that has had that kind of experience. I can't off the top of my head think of a pope with that kind of missionary experience, but also just that kind of global reach before becoming pope.
Right. He served in Peru for many, many years. He became a citizen there, in fact. Can you tell us more about what being a member and a leader in the Order of St. Augustine means? What does that indicate about his faith, about his philosophy?
He came out and he referenced a famous line of St. Augustine, with you, I am a Christian, and for you, I am a bishop. And I think it was really telling. There is this sense that he is a man who takes accompaniment very seriously, that he was beloved in Peru because he was a man of the people. And so this sense of we are Christians together first, and that I am a bishop for you, is a real humble. He's known to have be humble in his approach to authority and to how he kind of wears responsibility. But also, he had the trust of his fellow Augustinians for them to elect him prior general twice.
Yeah, lots of leadership experience, too. There has been growing division within the church. Cardinals seem split on whether to follow a more progressive path as established by the late Pope Francis or to return to a more conservative tradition. What does the election of Leo XIV tell you about the path going forward?
What it tells me is twofold. One, it tells me that the cardinals picked somebody who was known for being a bridge builder. At the same time, it also tells me that some of the key aspects of Pope Francis's papacy are going to stay front and center. So he is also someone who has prioritized in his ministry walking with and concern for the poor. Mm. He has welcome and concern for migrants. His selection of name is a nod to that in choosing Leo to be Leo XIV.
Megan, in just a few seconds before I have to let you go, I understand that the new pope has not said much in the past about the church's most divisive subjects, including same-sex blessings, women being ordained, priestly celibacy. Does that mean there are a lot of question marks still about those divisive issues and how he will lead on them?
I think time will tell. I think it also shows that this wasn't necessarily a statement on those things, right? That maybe those issues weren't what was front and center.
Megan Clark is a professor of moral theology at St. John's University in New York. She has been talking us through reaction today to the election of Robert Francis Prevost as the new pope, now known as Pope Leo XIV. Thank you so much, Megan.
Thank you for having me.
Community kitchens have been lifelines for hundreds of thousands of Palestinians in Gaza, especially since Israel cut off deliveries of humanitarian aid and commercial supplies to the Strip in early March. 2 months later, dozens of these kitchens have shut down. Sean Carroll is the CEO of the American Near East Refugee Aid, a relief group that's been operating in Gaza since before the current war. In an op-ed in the New York Times, he's written that a full-blown humanitarian emergency in Gaza is no longer looming. It is here and it is catastrophic. Sean, what are you seeing that for you pushes this crisis over the line from looming emergency to present tense catastrophe?
Well, we're seeing that all of the aid groups are either out of food or very shortly will be. The World Food Program distributed their last goods from their warehouses about 10 days ago. World Central Kitchen ran out of food yesterday. ANIRA, my organization, is on the last dregs of food, and it's mostly just lentils. So rice is out, flour is out, cooking oil is out. We're also seeing in our community healthcare centers that high levels of ketones showing up in urine samples, and that means that the bodies are starving. They're starting to eat their fat. So that's now gone up to about 40% of the lab samples are coming back with ketones indicating starvation.
So has any food at all gotten into Gaza in recent months?
Well, there's been what's been called a blockade for over 2 months.
Right.
There have been a couple of isolated incidents of something getting in. Yesterday, we helped coordinate a shipment to the Emirati Field Hospital. But basically, the borders have been closed except for a few exceptional cases.
Mm.
The world has got to let aid back in. And then there are questions of exactly how that's going to be done. And we're worried about some of the proposed plans for making that happen.
Yeah, I want to get to that now. In recent days, the U.S. government has been pressuring humanitarian groups to get behind a new Israeli aid plan that would push Gazans into a small enclave near the southern border with Egypt. The idea would be that aid would be provided there in centers run by American security contractors. Has your organization been asked to participate in this plan?
We have been. We've been briefed, and what we're seeing suggests that we can't do it. And that's what all of the UN agencies and most of the international NGOs are. That's the assessment they're making. And the first rule of humanitarian assistance is there has to be humanity, right? So there's a lot of humanity missing. A second one is impartiality, that no party to a conflict can be determining what aid goes in, when, and how, and to whom. And of course, Israel has always and will continue to have control on inspections and on the borders. but we can't give up impartiality. And that goes for any part of the conflict. There are NGOs that have in the past been pressured by Hamas to do something, and they've said, we can't do that. And if you insist, then we have to stop work and leave. And it should be the same for Israel or any party to the conflict.
Have you given a final answer to the Trump administration on whether you all participate?
Well, we're still talking. We're listening. We're talking with organizations. We got a briefing this morning from a Trump administration official on the plan, and we're talking with our own team on the ground and our staff and with staff from other NGOs and UN agencies. And ANIRO over the past 19 months has been the NGO that has delivered the most in Gaza, and we're
right
among the most with along with UNRWA and the World Food Program. And leaders are saying they just can't do this. It just would go against everything that we practice, that we're taught. And we fear that if you have armed contractors there and there's desperation and maybe there's not enough food for the need and people are coming down south to where they hear there's food available and they all come down and there's not enough, you can imagine what kind of chaos and violence could ensue.
Sean, this new proposal being presented by the Israelis and backed by the U.S. is being presented as a way to get around the interference of Hamas stealing food aid and selling it. Are you saying that you have no knowledge of that happening?
You know, I don't dispute that everyone in Gaza, including combatant groups, are trying to figure out how to feed themselves. But I can say that we and other organizations that we speak closely with, I mean, I've asked point blank because we need to know, has this been a problem for you? And from the beginning of this war, that issue has not been a major issue, and for us, seemingly not an issue.
But there are examples. Just from this week, one group of armed men broke into two or three bakeries in Gaza City and then targeted a soup kitchen. So this is happening.
Yeah, well, at this point, things are so desperate. You know, we've always said if you keep the supply up to anywhere near what's needed, then this does go away, and we saw that.
Israel says starvation is not imminent in Gaza. We want to play a clip here of Israeli government spokesperson David Mentzer speaking to reporters this week.
Our assessment is that there is food in Gaza. The hunger story is being engineered by Hamas, and it's being repeated, unfortunately, without question, by too many of the media.
How do you respond to that, Sean?
Well, I told you what our lab technicians and our community health centers are seeing in terms of ketones in urine samples, which indicate starvation. So I don't think that that's accurate.
Israel seems to be going ahead and has reportedly started setting up the humanitarian hubs in southern Gaza. Can that effort get off the ground without the participation of major Western relief groups like yours? And if it does, what will that mean?
I don't know. That is a big question. There are a lot of organizations. Maybe some will do it. Contractors are being hired. I do think it would be dangerous if only armed logistics and security contractors are doing the work. I think there is a need for humanitarian organizations, whether it's UN agencies, international NGOs, or local NGOs. I think it will be very difficult to do that work without the knowledge and the specific expertise. Does it have to include all of us? No, of course not. There are a lot of us. But also what I've said from the beginning is we actually are all needed and we all need to do as much as we can because that's how big the work is. If the largest agency providing aid and services in normal times and during the war, which is UNRWA, the UN agency, if they are hampered, then we all need to step up and do as much as we can. But even if UNRWA is at full strength, we still all need to do everything we can. So I think it will be an issue of volume and of effectiveness if some, and even more so obviously, if many of us cannot do this work or choose not to do it under the conditions that are being proposed. But we'll see.
Sean, I hope you don't find this rude to say, but you sound very tired.
I am tired. I'm tired. I'm sad, and I'm frustrated, and I'm angry, and I'm thinking every minute of our team in Gaza, our team in Ramallah that's supporting that team. We're all very tired. We're tired of being restricted in our work, and we're tired of not having the trust that we deserve to do this in the right way.
Sean Carroll is the CEO of ANIRA, the American Near East Refugee Aid, a relief group with longstanding presence in Gaza. Sean, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. In rural Ghana, getting to the hospital in time to give birth can be a challenge. Roads are rocky and narrow, and it can take hours to travel short distances. But as The World's transportation correspondent Jeremy Siegel reports, there is a way to speed things along when it counts.
In the rolling hills of northern Ghana, a vehicle zooms by on a dirt road in the darkness. It might sound like your usual ambulance, but it's something totally different. Three wheels instead of four. A lot smaller and more nimble, yet beefed up to handle rocky roads and narrow lanes, while still carrying patients, nurses, and essential medical equipment. It's also one-tenth the price of a traditional ambulance.
There's a driver's compartment in the front. There's a patient compartment in the back.
Emily Young is the co-founder and CEO of Moving Health, a startup aiming to transform maternal health care in rural Ghana, where access to ambulances is severely limited. Hiring a motorcycle driver is usually your safest bet for an emergency.
An example of the challenges that someone might face in this area, I think, can be illustrated by a story of a woman that I met in Nabulo, Ghana. She realized that she had a pregnancy complication and she needed to go to the hospital. There were no options besides calling a local motorcycle driver. It's extremely painful. She's already started the labor process, and the motorcycle slipped and they crashed.
They got back on the bike, and she made it to the hospital, covered in blood and mud from the crash. The 17-year-old and her baby miraculously survived.
But I think the crazy thing about that story is that she counts as a successful birth statistic because neither of them died.
While developing Moving Health, Young and her colleagues spoke with local nurses, midwives, and doctors on the ground in Ghana. The country's maternal mortality rate is four times worse than the international standard. Young discovered that what rural communities needed most was transportation that could actually handle rough terrain while still being cost-effective and easy to scale at a local level. So Emily got her hands dirty.
This is where we welded the first prototype, right in here.
It's not that glamorous.
No, no, it's not, but it gets the job done.
Young takes me on a tour of MIT D-Lab in Cambridge, where she first came up with the idea as a student. It's a facility where researchers work with young engineers on practical solutions to global poverty challenges. Rather than coming up with complex new technologies, they often use existing devices, things that you can scavenge for yourself.
The first prototype that we made, I learned how to weld. We had built this trailer that could be pulled behind the back of a motorcycle. But in the final presentation for the class, we sat on it and it broke.
A decade later, and the project has come a long way from the classroom. They now have fleets of ambulance tricycles that are manufactured in Ghana. They partnered with locals like Isaac Amoa Kwanza, who's become the nonprofit's CTO. He says they now serve more than 100,000 people and have been able to cut the average time it takes to get to the hospital in half.
Sometimes you can see that the joy a mother expresses or her family expresses because Moving Health ambulance was in this community to carry their relative to the next level, they always appreciate what we do.
Still, the road ahead isn't smooth. There are funding constraints, and tariffs could drive up prices for the materials they use. But Kwanza says the team is in it for the long haul and hopes to expand in Ghana and around the continent, because in rural communities, access to emergency transportation isn't a luxury. It's a necessity. For The World, I'm Jeremy Siegel.
At Kurdish weddings, there is one ubiquitous sound. It's a frame drum known as a daf, and it's a big part of traditional music styles from throughout the Middle East. As The World's Duri Buscarin reports, daf enthusiasts are now trying to bring this ancient instrument into the modern world.
As a kid, Berhan Gujman played the cello in Zurich. But one day, a teacher introduced him to the daf, a shallow frame drum about the size of a medium pizza.
Ve benim için o gün Batı müziği bitti. Ben bu enstrümana aşık oldum.
Western music was over for me that day, Gujman tells me. I fell in love with this instrument. The daf appears across the Middle East and North Africa, but it's particularly beloved by Kurdish musicians. And in Diyarbakir, Gujman's hometown, the daf is a familiar sight, on the street, at weddings and holidays.
Kullanım alanları hayatta daha mutlu.
In the happiest moments of our lives, the most exciting, these are the instruments that we play, Gujman says. As Gujman plays the daf, he holds it upright in front of him, hitting the goat skin stretched across the top, while shaking the drum so chains of small metal rings keep a second rhythm in the background. It's chaotic, but rhythmic at the same time. And it's been played this way for at least 2,500 years. Drummers used the daf to send warriors into battle, to welcome them home, and to celebrate the holidays.
O yüzden bu coğrafyada yaşayan, bu kimliği taşıyan...
Everyone who lives in this geography, who comes from this identity and is founded in this culture, has a love for the daf inside them, Gujman says. But for a long time, only one traditional daf maker remained here in Diyarbakir. Most of the drums available for sale in the city's old marketplace are brought in from Iran.
Genelde pop müzik ve arabesk müzik dinlemek istiyor.
People want to listen to pop music or Turkish arabesque, Gujman says. So we're getting a bit distanced from our culture. By our culture, he means Kurdish culture. And Gujman was not willing to let the daf die a slow death. So he teamed up with a high school friend, Hamza Kartal, and they learned to make the drums themselves. On TikTok and Instagram, they shared the process with friends, finding real goatskin hides and working them into the frames with hammers and a staple gun.
Yani iki kişi sadece el aletleri kullanarak.
Two people can make 30 in a day, Gujman says, using only hand tools, no machines.
Tabii, onu da yapıyoruz. O yaptığımız işler de var.
Today, Gujman shows me around a brightly lit storefront. He and Kartal named their brand Alefra Percussion, after the Syriac word for the rising sun. Upstairs is a practice studio for local students to come for lessons. Over the years, they've expanded to making other types of traditional drums, from the West African shikere to frame drums from North American indigenous tribes. But the daf is where it all began for Gujman. The daf is an indispensable instrument for all of us, Gujman says. It has witnessed every moment of our lives and our struggle for existence. To Gujman, preserving traditional Kurdish music is as crucial as preserving the Kurdish language, his mother tongue. Though we've spent this interview speaking Turkish, a second language we share, neither of us can fully express ourselves, Gujman says.
İşte bunun için kendini doğru ifade edebilmek ve gönlünce yaşayabilmek için insan...
In order to express yourself correctly and live with your heart, Gujman says, you have to preserve your own language. And to him, the daf is another way to speak it. For the world, I'm Dari Buscarin, Diyarbakir, Turkey.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. In London, members of the British royal family wrapped up 4 days of celebrations across the United Kingdom. King Charles and Prince William laid wreaths inside Westminster Abbey to mark the 80th anniversary of Victory in Europe Day. On May 8, 1945, the Nazis' unconditional surrender that ended World War II in Europe was announced. The new international order that emerged is a rules-based system that's shaped world affairs and the global economy in the decades since, but that system is now under unprecedented strain. The World's Matthew Bell has our story.
By the time it was all over, tens of millions of people were dead. Entire cities were reduced to rubble. No wonder there were spontaneous celebrations 80 years ago today.
Throughout the world, throngs of people hailed the end of the war in Europe. It is 5 years and more since Hitler marched into Poland. Years full of suffering and death and sacrifice. Now the war against Germany is won.
President Harry Truman announced the news here in the United States.
General Eisenhower informs me that the forces of Germany have surrendered to the United Nations. The flags of freedom fly all over Europe.
My dear friends, this is your hour.
This is part of Winston Churchill's victory speech, read by the actor Timothy Spall. He played Churchill in The King's Speech.
This is not a victory of a party or of any class. It's a victory of the great British nation as a whole. We were the first in this ancient Ireland to draw the sword against tyranny.
Spall's reading kicked off this week's VE Day celebrations in the UK. London hosted a military parade with 1,300 troops. There were celebrations in Paris and even in Berlin. Alan Packwood is the director of the Churchill Archives Center at Churchill College in Cambridge, England. If you go back to 1940, when German planes were bombing Britain, Packwood says it was not a given that Prime Minister Churchill would be able to forge an alliance with the American president.
He and Roosevelt don't always see eye to eye on strategy, but what they managed to create is an unprecedented alliance in war of the two countries, with American troops serving under British commanders and vice versa.
After the war, that same alliance played a key role in creating the foundations for a new global order.
These are things like NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, the United Nations, the Court of Human Rights, all of these sort of structures that we take for granted.
Over the last 80 years, the U.S. and much of Europe have worked together to expand the system of international law and commerce. Ivo Dalder is a former U.S. ambassador to NATO.
But like oxygen, you don't really understand how important it is to living until you no longer have it. And in some ways, we're celebrating the 80th anniversary of a global system just as that system is collapsing.
Dalder, who's the CEO of the Chicago Council on Global Affairs, just returned from a trip to Europe. He says many people there are alarmed by President Trump's return to power and his administration's embrace of the far right in Europe. Dalder says the new tone from Washington is undermining old alliances.
Increasingly, the Europeans are looking towards themselves and saying, we can no longer trust the United States. We need to be friends among ourselves, find friends elsewhere. But the United States is no longer part of that.
In a speech commemorating VE Day today, Germany's president, Frank-Walter Steinmeier, said, we are all children of the 8th of May. He criticized Russia for its war of aggression in Ukraine, but he also took aim at the United States. The new American administration has a very different worldview to ours, Steinmeier said, one that has no regard for established rules, partnership, and established trust. For The World, I'm Matthew Bell.
British and American diplomats like to talk about a special relationship between the U.S. and the U.K. Now the two countries have a trade deal, the first international trade deal for the Trump administration since its universal levies sparked a trade war. It's also been seen as a win for Britain's Prime Minister, Keir Starmer. He has been trying to redefine the U.K.'s trade relationships post-Brexit through negotiations with key trading partners around the world. Marco Forgione is the Director General of the Chartered Institute of Export and International Trade, where he facilitates trade between the U.K. and the rest of the world.
Well, we've got a little bit of detail and certainly some top-line numbers, particularly with regards to steel, aluminium, automotive, aerospace, and some detail on agriculture. We've also got a clear indication that this is an ongoing process where the two sides are going to work constructively to secure detail on a number of other areas.
So what does the UK stand to gain from this based on the details you have access to?
Well, there's a great opportunity for the UK, particularly with tariffs on aluminium and steel going into the US being zero rated. Car makers can sell 100,000 of our first class cars into the US at a 10% rate. We've also got access into the US beef market on a much reduced tariff rate. So all of it really positive.
Do you see this as a significant moment in British trade policy in the post-Brexit era?
This is a really important week. for UK trade, because just 2 days ago we secured a deal with India.
Right.
Now we're the first to secure a new trade relationship with the US, the first of President Trump's administration. So I think it's clear that as President Trump implements his very muscular plan to unpick the global multilateral system and to rewrite the terms under which global trade takes place, that actually the United Kingdom is at the forefront of supporting that restructure.
I'm curious, it has been 5 years since Brexit became official, when the UK exited the EU and all the trade implications that brought with it went into effect. What so far has that meant for UK trade?
So for UK trade, over the past 5 years, we've seen a pretty significant reduction in the number of businesses and the amount of businesses trading internationally. So we've seen our exports decline, particularly with the EU as a result of Brexit, but also trade with the rest of the world. Now, we have seen some of that pick up in the last couple of years with the rest of the world, but certainly not to the levels that existed 5 years ago. Now, part of that will be Brexit, but we've also had COVID, and we've had the global supply chain meltdown. We've had war on mainland Europe, the slowdown in the world economy. So there's lots of other factors, but certainly Brexit has played a role in creating difficulty for UK businesses and the UK economy.
How does this contraction in exports specifically compare with how pro-Brexit folks were selling the trade impact that it would have? I recall that at least one of the things that was said by those who supported Brexit was that the trade deficit would narrow.
Yes, there were lots of comments made during the campaign and immediately after. And, you know, I'm not going to get into the party politics of this. I think
sure.
The reality is it's had an economic impact on the UK. We've seen the UK economy stall. We've not seen the growth that we've needed. The UK now, as an independent trading nation, does have the freedom to secure deals such as that signed today with the US, like the one signed with India, and the agreement to enter the CPTPP, the Southeast Asia and South America trade community, and at the same time have the largest free trade agreement in the world with the EU. So I think we're beginning to see now what the UK as an independent trading nation is able to achieve, but it's doing that as a collaborator and a partner with other nations.
But can a patchwork of deals negotiated by Starmer actually provide what EU membership once did when it comes to trade? Maybe looking out another 5-10 years?
If you look ahead, you have to look at where growth markets are. And the global economy is changing. You've got the global south, which is certainly becoming much more economically developed, much more outward looking in its trade flows. You've got the high growth markets. You look at what's happening with India as it's moving up the GDP rankings. So the world economy is changing. It's really important, particularly for an independent trading nation like the UK, that it is forging those close collaborations and establishing trading partnerships internationally.
Marco Forgione joined us from the Chartered Institute of Export and International Trade. There is one export from the UK that is looking particularly strong: reality television. The Financial Times reports that British television was behind a third of all new unscripted TV adaptations worldwide. Think MasterChef.
I've never heard of it, never seen it, never tasted it, never cooked with it. I'm screwed. I'm going home.
Love Island.
On a scale of 1 to 10, how confident am I?
11.
And game shows like newcomer The 1% Club.
The global phenomenon comes to the U.S.
I love it!
Don't worry if you're not good at trivia, because our questions test common sense and how your brain actually works.
Overseas adaptations of popular British franchises increased by 18% last year. The Financial Times points out that domestic shows with an appeal in foreign markets are a pretty good bet, even in uncertain times. An update now on a story we reported in the fall of 2022. It was about an overseas network of outposts for the Chinese police, often located in stores or travel agencies. These so-called police stations were accused of running a pressure campaign to get dissidents to return to China. Their tactics included following and harassing people and getting family members arrested back home. One Chinese dissident in the story, Wang Jinyu, had received asylum in the Netherlands. Questions about his credibility have since come to light. The World's Jerry Hatton reports.
When the story broke about the Chinese overseas stations, Wang's name was everywhere. In newspapers, television, online, I spoke to him about what he said was a campaign of intimidation meant to coerce him home to China.
I just walking on the street. A man, you know, his clothes, like the People's Republic of China Army, he stopped me. And he said, you are criminal. I will catch you like this, many, many times like this.
Wang, who'd fled for Dubai, initially had lots of stories and backers. I first heard about him from someone named Laura Harth. Harth is with a Madrid-based NGO called Safeguard Defenders. The organization had published a bombshell report on Chinese transnational harassment of critics and criminals.
We came across Wang Jingju the first time when he was held in Dubai. He was mentioned in a January 2022 report of us as someone who had been or claimed to have been at risk of deportation from Dubai.
Wang was soon granted asylum in the Netherlands. With Safeguard Defenders' help, I interviewed him. Another story, he told me, that an undercover Chinese agent had summoned him to a local Starbucks to talk or else.
He asked me to meet with them, asked me to go back to China to solve my problem, also he asked me thinking about my parents.
Wang said that that was a veiled threat against his family. He called the police, he says. When I asked for supporting evidence, he sent me a short video from his phone showing two Dutch policemen approaching an Asian-looking man in a Starbucks. I wrote to the Dutch police asking for details. Their response, we can't comment on an open investigation.
We begin in China. It's been extending its influence across the globe, and one way it's been doing that is by setting up overseas police stations.
Soon after, my story went to air. That was November 2022. I included the Starbucks incident since the Dutch police had implied it was investigating. And more broadly, I included Wang because he seemed legit. Then, last August, I got a message on Signal.
My name is Frank Langfitt, and I'm NPR's roving national correspondent.
I interviewed Langfitt a few months later.
I was looking into potential stories about Chinese transnational repression against dissidents and other critics who were overseas, because I'd seen this happen when I was based in Europe, in London. I covered these stories and I knew that they were genuine. A lot of them were absolutely true and it was a pattern.
While investigating, though, Langfitt discovered a falsehood in one of Wang's stories. Wang claimed that Chinese authorities had made fake bomb threats in the name of another dissident in Thailand. The tactic was meant to force Thai police to detain the man. The bomb threat itself was allegedly made in the Netherlands.
Wang had provided us as the only real hard evidence of the accusations against the Chinese government about these bomb threats, emails that they said had come from the Dutch Immigration Service. And I read the emails and they seemed to confirm the story.
But when Langfitt called Dutch Immigration, they said the emails were fakes. The bomb threat was a hoax with Wang at the heart of it. My story didn't include that threat, but Langfitt's investigation cast doubt on everything Wang had told me, including the stalker at Starbucks. After many tries, I finally reach Wang via Signal.
Hello.
Hello, Jingyu?
Yeah.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Thank you for agreeing to do this interview.
Yeah.
I ask Wang about NPR's findings. He denies the Dutch emails are fake, then says he's going to sue Frank Langfitt. When I ask him about what happened with the man in Starbucks.
Actually, I don't have the future information because they told me they are prosecuted this, but police department, they cannot give me any future information.
They were prosecuting this person, but they couldn't give you any information about it?
Actually, 2 years ago, I think, yeah.
Did you follow up with them about that? Because it seems like if they were prosecuting this person and you were the victim, that you would have been called to the trial.
Actually, nobody contacted me about this, yeah.
You just let it go?
Yeah.
Okay.
I reached out to the Dutch police again, but haven't gotten a response. Today, Safeguard Defenders disavows Wong. Laura Harth describes him as not a credible person. But like Langfitt and prosecutors in the U.S. and Europe, Harth says Chinese transnational harassment of dissidents is real and ongoing, even if some individuals lie about their cases.
Finding a balance between making sure that people are helped when they are in need or when they express a need, and balancing, you know, how much can you verify certain things. And I think this is the lesson that everybody's going through on a continuous basis.
In the heat of a human rights emergency, she says, sometimes there's just not enough time to thoroughly vet the person you're helping. As for Wang Jingyu, unless he can refute the evidence of his forgery and provide credible proof of his other claims, he's become persona non grata for human rights advocates. Over the last couple of years, the U.S. Justice Department has indicted dozens of Chinese operatives for transnational repression. Last month, the International Consortium of Investigative Journalism published a report detailing hundreds of cases of overseas coercion, intimidation, and harassment. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. It's hot in Japan this year, and that's got people worried coming off of 2024, which was the country's hottest year on record since 1898, the entire globe's hottest year on record as well. National Geographic explorer Paul Salopek was in Japan last year walking through rice fields. As part of a long journey tracing human migration by foot, he and his photographer experienced the heat firsthand and witnessed how it affected the rice crop and the farming communities behind it. Paul joined us to talk about that today. Paul, thanks for being with us again.
It's great to be with you. Thanks.
So can you describe what it was like to be walking through those rice fields in Japan in that extreme heat?
Yeah, it was something else. After having kind of walked through extreme heat in South Korea, I was hoping for a little coolness in Japan. It didn't happen. As you mentioned, it was the hottest year on record for Japan. And in fact, it was the second hottest year on record 2 years in a row. And it was like walking through a furnace and breathing through wet cotton balls. Very humid and very, very steamy, blistering hot. Yeah,
I can imagine it when you say it. I can't quite picture, though, the rice fields. Can you tell me what they are kind of supposed to look like when the weather is normal, and then what they looked like when you were walking through the Japanese rice paddy during the heat wave?
Well, generally, they're big panes of green, right, or yellow, depending on what stage of the harvest or the growth cycle you're in. So just imagine, you know, rice fields are kind of artificial human-made wetlands. So you see stands of green rice stems, sometimes with heads of rice hanging on them, and then there's water that's reflecting the sun kind of in a million kind of diamond glints. So it's actually very pretty. What was different this year, and I think it's probably incremental in Japan, is that they're just, in terms of family rice paddies, they're just fewer and fewer. Some are dried up because the farmers are quitting.
You mentioned that you didn't see a lot of people in the rice fields. Was that because of the heat?
Yeah, well, that does explain at least partly why some of them have gone fallow, these kind of dried up paddies. Is partly it's Japan's aging population and just fewer and fewer people around who want to kind of work the land. You know, it's never an easy job. But the second is the heat. In fact, several farmers that I spoke with explicitly told me, saying, Paul, this is a hard enough job already, but these record heat waves, I'm 78, I'm 81. My body can't take it anymore. This will be my last year doing this.
Wow. And how were people coping? Can you tell me more about the people that you were meeting out there in the fields?
Well, they were covered up, as I, you know, they always cover up against the sun. But I think they said that they were working earlier and later in the day and taking off the middle parts of the day. You know, it's kind of like living.
That makes sense.
Living in the kind of the Saudi desert, as it will. These kind of same desert survival techniques that have come to kind of green and humid Japan. It was a bit surreal.
For a lot of families there, rice growing goes back generations. How much was it part of the identity there, people's identity and their sense of self?
Well, I think rice has been grown in this part of the world for thousands of years. In fact, rice crops are probably one of the original crops that we tamed as human beings going back, gosh, some scientists say 13,000 years. And if you do that, you know, if you grow rice for 13,000 years, you certainly develop a palate for it. And so I think the Japanese are famous for kind of being very careful about what kind of rice they eat. They have their favorite rice, and rice is, you know, there's so much that's wrapped up, not just food, but, you know, construction materials, artwork, sandals, tatami mats. Rice provides a foundation for a lot of traditional Japanese life.
And the people that you were speaking to who mentioned that, you know, they were going to have to stop farming, I mean, did that feel like a loss to them in terms of their own personal identity?
You know, it varied. There were some farmers who looked at it to like a relief. And then, you know, one guy said basically, hey, it's up to the younger generation to toil bent over, you know, in this furnace like weather. Good luck to them. I'm going to take a holiday for the rest of my life.
They're ready to retire.
Yeah. And, you know, other farmers were like, yeah, this is kind of a tragedy. There's kind of a breaking of a traditional system of knowledge that's been going on for many, many generations. And who's going to take it up? The real question is, what happens next? And several people said, well, these small farms that are being slowly abandoned, partly because of the global warming, will probably be consolidated into bigger mechanized farms, right? The kind of more kind of industrial farming that much of the world knows.
You mentioned that farmers are shifting their working hours to adapt to the heat. Are they changing their actual growing practices?
Some are experimenting with different crops. I talked to a guy who said that, you know, he's been trying, since rice farming is getting a bit dodgy because of the heat, he's trying tropical fruits, but he said the soil isn't appropriate. So now they're kind of trying to shift to different varieties of rice that might do better in the hot weather. Yeah.
We've been talking about the farmers and the rice crop. I'm wondering, other folks you met when there was this extreme heat, how were they adapting or dealing with the heat? What kind of an impact was it having on people? Where were they trying to seek refuge, I guess?
Well, that's, again, it goes back to kind of the surreality of walking through this part of Honshu, the main island of Japan, with so few people in it. I wish I could answer you, but I couldn't find hardly anybody to ask this question. They were all indoors, right? So me and my walking partner, the photographer Soichiro Koriyama, were like the only two crazy guys out in the heat with backpacks kind of slogging through the landscape. Truly. I mean, it was, you know, my project is based on talking to people, and I had trouble finding people.
Yeah, they were all inside seeking refuge.
Yeah, or also many of these villages were largely abandoned, right? Again, through the aging population, hyper-urbanization. Global warming was like, you know, just the last straw, literally. This kind of people are not there anymore.
So you are still in Japan. You're continuing your walk. What is the next stop on your journey?
Well, I've got about 340 kilometers left. I'll be crossing through a part of the Japanese Alps, headed for the port of Yokohama, then hope to jump on a cargo ship and then steam over to North America. That's the plan.
Wow, that'll be a big sea crossing for you.
It's a major pivot in this whole project, yeah. Leaving the old world for the first time in almost 13 years, yeah.
Wow. And so 300-odd kilometers left of walking in Japan, and then you set sail.
That's right. I think it's a 12-day crossing of the North Pacific.
Well, I'm excited to talk with you then about what it's like not to walk for 12 days after doing so much walking for so many years.
Yeah, it'll be different. Maybe I'll just walk around the deck.
Got to get your steps in somehow.
Yes, indeed.
Paul Salopek is a National Geographic explorer on a years-long walking journey, tracing the path of human migration. Paul, great to talk to you as always. Thank you so much.
Always a pleasure. Thank you for having me on.
The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. Find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Carolyn Beeler. See you back here tomorrow.
The World is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. From the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include the Kelsen Foundation, Roman Mars, Gavin Selmanese, LLC, the Schmidt Family Foundation, Ed and Lillian Schneider. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. From PRX.